Chapter 14. HMS Belfast is a gunship of 11,000 tons, commissioned in 1939, which saw active service in the Second World War. Since then, it has been moored on the south bank of the Thames, in postcard land, between Tower Bridge and London Bridge, opposite the Tower of London. From its deck, one can see St. Paul's Cathedral and the gilt top of the column-like monument to the Great Fire of London, erected, as so much of London was erected, by Christopher Wren. The ship serves as a floating museum, as a memorial, as a training ground. There is a walkway onto the ship from the shore, and they came down the walkway in their twos and threes and in their dozens. They set up their stalls as early as they could, all the tribes of London below, united both by the market truce and by a mutual desire to pitch their own stalls as far as possible from the sewer folk stall. It had been agreed well over a century before that the sewer folk could only set up a stall at those markets held in the open air. Dunnikin and his folk dumped their booty in a large pile on a rubber sheet beneath a large gun tower. Nobody ever came to the sewer folk's stall immediately, but towards the end of the market they would come, the bargain hunters, the curious, and those few fortunate individuals blessed with no sense of smell. Richard and Hunter and Dorr pushed their way through the crowds on the deck. Richard realized that he had somehow lost the need to stop and stare. The people here were no less strange than at the last floating market, but, he supposed, he was every bit as strange to them, wasn't he? He looked around, scanning the faces in the crowd as they walked, hunting for the Marquis's ironic smile. "I don't see him," he said. They were approaching a smith's stall, where a man who could easily have passed for a small mountain, if one were to overlook the shaggy brown beard, tossed a lump of red molten metal from a brazier onto an anvil. Richard had never seen a real anvil before. He could feel the heat from the molten metal and the brazier from a dozen feet away. "Keep looking. De Caribus will turn up," said Dorr, looking behind them. "Like a bad penny." She thought for a moment and added, "What exactly is a bad penny, anyway?" And then, before Richard could answer, she squealed, "Hammersmith!" The bearded mountain man looked up, stopped hitting the molten metal, and roared, "By the temple and the arch, Lady Dorr!" Then he picked her up as if she weighed no more than a mouse. "Hello, Hammersmith," said Dorr. "I hoped you'd be here."
"Never miss a market, lady," he thundered cheerfully.
Then he confided, like an explosion with a secret,
"This is where the business is, you see. Now," he said,
recollecting the cooling lump of metal on his anvil,
"just you wait here a moment."
He put Dorr down, at eye level, on the top of his booth, 7 feet above the deck. He banged the lump of metal with his hammer, twisting it as he did so with implements Richard assumed, correctly, were tongs. Under the hammer blows, it changed from a shapeless blob of orange metal into a perfect black rose. It was a work of astonishing delicacy, each petal perfect and distinct. Hammersmith dipped the rose into a bucket of cold water beside the anvil. It hissed and steamed. Then he pulled it out of the bucket, wiped it, and handed it to a fat man in chainmail who was standing patiently to one side. The fat man professed himself well satisfied and gave Hammersmith, in return, a green plastic Marks and Spencer shopping bag filled with various kinds of cheese. "Hammersmith," said Dorr from her perch, "these are my friends." Hammersmith enveloped Richard's hand in one several sizes up. His handshake was enthusiastic but very gentle, as if he had, in the past, had a number of accidents shaking hands and had practiced it until he got it right.
"Charmed,"
he boomed.
"Richard,"
said Richard. Hammersmith looked delighted.
"Richard! Fine name! I had a horse called Richard."
He let go of Richard's hand, turned to Hunter and said,
"And you are..." "Hunter? Hunter! As I live, breathe, and defecate it is!"
Hammersmith blushed, like a schoolboy. He spat on his hand and attempted, awkwardly, to plaster his hair back. Then he stuck his hand out and realized that he had just spat on it, and he wiped it on his leather apron and shifted his weight from foot to foot. "Hammersmith?" said Hunter, with a perfect caramel smile. "Hammersmith?" asked Dor. "Will you help me down?" He looked shamefaced.
"Beg pardon, lady,"
he said, and lifted her down. It came to Richard then that Hammersmith had known Dor as a small child, and he found himself feeling unaccountably jealous of the huge man.
"Now,"
Hammersmith was saying to Dor,
"what can I do for you?"
"Couple of things," she said, "but first of all," she turned to Richard. "Richard, I've got a job for you." Hunter raised an eyebrow. "For him?" Dor nodded. "For both of you. Will you go and find us some food, please?" Richard felt oddly proud. He had proved himself in the ordeal. He was one of them. He would go and he would bring back food. He puffed out his chest. "I am your bodyguard. I stay by your side," said Hunter. Dor grinned. Her opal-coloured eyes flashed. "In the market? It's okay, Hunter. Market truce holds. No one's going to touch me here. And Richard needs looking after more than I do." Richard deflated, but no one was watching. "And what if someone violated the truce?" asked Hunter. Hammersmith shivered, despite the heat of his brazier.
"Violate the market truce? Brrr."
"It's not going to happen. Go on, both of you. Curry, please. And get me some poppadoms, please. Spicy ones." Hunter ran her hand through her hair. And then she turned and walked off into the crowd, and Richard went with her. "So what would happen if someone violated market truce?" asked Richard as they pushed through the crowds. She thought about this for a moment. "The last time it happened was about 300 years ago. A couple of friends got into an argument over a woman in the market. A knife was pulled and one of them died. The other fled." "What happened to him? Was he killed?" Hunter shook her head. "Quite the opposite. He still wishes he had been the one to have died." "He's still alive." Hunter pursed her lips. "Ish," she said after a while. "Alive-ish." A moment passed. "Phew," Richard said, thinking he was going to be ill. "What's that? That stink?" "Sewer folk." Richard averted his head and tried not to breathe through his nose until they were well away from the sewer folk's stall. "Any sign of the Marquis yet?" he asked. Hunter shook her head. She could have reached out her hand and touched him. They went up a gangplank toward the food stalls and more welcoming aromas.